All right, so I'll just kind of get things started here by telling you, I know that in the email it gave a little bit of John DeShepley and Jim Davis's background, who are our ACA members hosting today's call. They are both from our incredible Ohio contingent of ACA members, both very active within the organization. John's a member of the board of directors. I think they have quite different practices. John is a solo practitioner in the Cincinnati area, and Jim is in, well, has been working in a partnership for several years. They just took on another partner and some additional staff. So I think they'll each be able to share their perspectives and let you know a little bit more about their practice, how they came to ACA, and the benefits that they've received from membership. So, Jim, if you want to go ahead and kind of get things started, just talk a little bit about your practice and kind of finish filling people in on what they should know about you.
Absolutely. Thanks, Kathy. I guess I would just give a little bit of background as to how I became a financial planner. Like many Cambridge folks or ACA folks, I am a career changer. And how I found out about ACA was my wife and I have been clients of an ACA advisor going back to 2002. And we had been working with this gentleman for probably about 3 years, and I really liked the process, and I'd always been interested in personal finance. And at that point, he gave me a book by Burt Whitehead, who started the organization. And I read it a couple times, and it really just clicked with me. And I said, hey, this is what I want to do when I grow up. So I went back and did all the CFP work and got that done in 2007. And it was at that point where I was said, okay, I'm going to go start my practice and started doing some more research. Obviously, I knew about Cambridge, but I wanted to do some other search with Garrett. And, you know, anything else that might be out there. And I went with Cambridge, or ACA, because it was explained to me this way, and it just really made a lot of sense. It said, when you join this organization, you are basically buying a business in a box where they will teach you how to be a financial planner and how to set up a practice and run a practice. So that just really clicked with me. Again, being a career changer and not really knowing what I was doing, that really sealed the deal for me. So I started going through the training in the summer of 07, 5 years ago, and I was impressed with the training. It was very in-depth, and it prepared me to change careers. You know, I don't have anything to compare it to, but I've talked to some former Garrett planners who are now with ACA, and they mentioned how more robust the ACA training was, again, how to be a financial planner and how to run a business. So and they're constantly tweaking and updating all the training materials and the process. And what you have to understand, too, that there have been a lot of really good folks in the organization. So even our founder, Bert, would tell you that with all of his wisdom that he uses a lot of stuff from that he's gleaned and learned from other advisors, and you'll get that through your training. I would imagine most of you are sold on, if you want to be a financial planner, on the whole fee-only concept, which is the present and the future of their business. There's no question about that. What separates us from other fee-only folks is the fact that we do truly comprehensive, holistic planning. We've taken on clients that have come from other fee-only planners that do the AUM model, assets under management, and they do a very good job of managing money. That's what they're known for. But a lot of other things come up with finances, tax planning. Should I refinance my mortgage? Should I take Social Security yet? Just a whole boatload of answers that folks that we've taken on did not get from a planner who just manages money. So what we can do is provide a soup-to-nuts financial plan for folks. We can be the jack of all trades because we're typically dealing with middle to upper middle income clients. So we're not dealing with super complex issues typically. We can truly do comprehensive planning for our folks, and it really works out well. I remember these one folks that we took on probably 3 years ago. They were with an AUM planner, and I was mentioning, you know, all the services we provide, this and this, and tax preparation and tax planning. And he said, well, wait a second, what do you mean tax planning? Well, I said, you know, tax preparation, that's part of what we do, but that's just kind of putting the numbers in the right box. The real value we provide our clients is tax planning. And he'd never heard of that before, and he was just blown away. Another thing that really impressed me was the community of this organization. And I don't mean to sound cheesy, but it's really a great group of folks that you are not out there on your own. You're going to get to know other folks in the organization who may be close to you locally, or maybe you serve on a committee, or folks you get to meet in your training class or at the annual update conference. You'll get to know folks and what they're really good at, and that becomes a wonderful resource in your practice. You'll meet folks and realize, hey, this guy is a whiz at ISOs or at estate planning. And you just kind of file that in the back of your head. And when the time comes, when that issue pops up, and if you have a question, not sure where to go, you pick up the phone and call that person. That's what part of your membership pays for. And I remember my first ACA conference, they had a little get-together for first-time attendees, and a gentleman got up and spoke who had been with the organization several years at that point and has become a very successful financial planner, said, you know, part of what you're paying for is access to this collective knowledge and wisdom of this group, this brain trust, and you get to tap into it. And he said he literally had three or four other ACA folks on speed dial when he first started out his first couple of years because, you know, there's questions that come up, you're not quite sure what you're doing, and he literally had these folks on speed dial, knowing that he can call them at any time for anything. And what I really like about this model is the way that we work with clients. We work with them on a retainer process where they write us a check. Well, some folks charge annually, some folks charge quarterly, but it's on a year-to-year relationship. And since you're doing comprehensive planning, the first year you're seeing them maybe six times, and subsequent years maybe three to four times, it becomes a very sticky situation where they're used to working with you, you can handle all their personal finances, meaning client retention is very high. We typically see our client retention 95% year over year. My partner started her practice about 16 years ago, and she still has folks that were clients from day one. So, you know, the hard part is getting that small core group of clients built up, and then once you have them, they'll start referring folks, and you'll have those folks for years to come. So the hard part is getting that initial cluster of clients. But the training will teach you how to attract those clients. I'm not saying, you know, sign up with ACA and your phone will start ringing off the hook. That's not what I'm saying, but it will give you the knowledge and the expertise and a strategy for attracting that core group of clients. So, again, this model is it's an ongoing relationship we have with our clients. It's not something where they pop in for an afternoon and you help them with a couple things and shoo them out of the office and they're on their own. Then you have to go out and find another client and another client. You build up a self-sustaining practice pretty quickly, and you get to build long-term relationships with your clients, and you really get to know them once you've had them for a couple of years and what motivates them and what makes them tick, and you can do even a better job for them. So that's what I really like. I know I'm kind of babbling on here, just to kind of wrap things up. I think it's a proven model to put a practice together on how to advise clients and how to attract clients. You can learn from others. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. This has been refined over the years from input from the greatest planners in the country that's in the business, hands down. So I would urge you to take a strong look at this organization if you truly want to do comprehensive planning. If you just want to manage money, this probably isn't a good fit. But I really think it's if you really want to make a difference in people's lives and really connect with them and really build a self-sustaining practice, this model lends itself to that, and you should highly consider it. Kathy?
Yeah, thanks, Jim. That was great. I'm sure that both Steve and Kim are going to have some questions for you.
Sure.
But I want to give John a chance to talk a little bit about himself and his practice and what ACA, his membership has meant and done for him, and then we'll kind of get more of a actual conversation going here. So, John?
Great, thanks. And Jim, in case you didn't know, Jim's kind of a shy and quiet kind of guy, and at some point may try to run for Congress and do a filibuster. So, I'm also I qualify as a career changer. I had been a CPA in a public accounting firm for a number of years, went out went and joined industry, worked as a controller for a mutual fund company, then that was in Boston, then moved to Cincinnati where I was also a controller for a mutual fund company that also did some high net worth money management. At that point, that company got bought out, and they wanted to move me to Cleveland. No disrespect to Cleveland. I actually was very impressed with Cleveland when I went up there and interviewed, but had only lived in Cincinnati a couple of years at that point and didn't feel like moving. So took that opportunity to go on the other side of the business and go to the sales side, where I worked for a high net worth money manager. And in that process is when I realized it wasn't a whole lot of fun doing that. We had folks that actually ran the money, you know, the CFA type folks, and I was what we referred to as a relationship manager and was dealing with the clients, and I had a particular niche in working with, for whatever reason, I ended up with a lot of the widows on my list of people to work with, and I often got a lot of questions of what to do with the money, and being a CPA, I would always talk to them about the tax consequences. I end up calling their accountants and this and that. And I said, you know what? And I've always sort of had an interest in personal financial planning. So at that point, I started doing research on what would it take for me to add the PFS designation to my CPA. I think both of you are in the process of doing that, or maybe you already have. And at that time, the process wasn't all that difficult because I already had a whole bunch of the Series 7 and 24 and 65 and all that stuff. All those exams qualified me, and I had enough hours in, so it wasn't that difficult. I didn't have to take the PFS exam. So I got my designation. I was doing research on both the Alliance of Cambridge Advisors and Garrett and a whole bunch of other things. I did read Nancy Langdon Jones' book, So You Want to Be a Financial Planner. I thought that was a tremendous resource. And I also had a financial planner locally here who was a NAPFA member. And much like Jim's story, I said, I want to do what you're doing. And they said, great, we'll help you. Go to a NAPFA conference. So I went to the NAPFA conference in 2004 in Toronto, and my planner was gracious enough to introduce me to as many people as possible. I actively sought out ACA members and Garrett members, it was funny. Even though I was a CPA, I didn't like the idea of ACA's focus on taxes. I thought that would be, you know, I never really enjoyed the tax side of things as a CPA. So I thought, well, I don't even know I should be good at this, and I don't know if I want to do that. Well, through that conference and meeting a lot of the members, I actually was invited to go out to dinner with some ACA members while I was there. I quickly learned that how I thought of myself operating as a sole practitioner was much more in line with the ACA philosophy than it was the Garrett philosophy. And again, I'm not trying to pick sides. I'm just saying that was for me because I got the feeling that you build relationships with your clients and that it's much more of a long-term circumstance. And a lot of my personality is along those lines. It's not, I like to get to know people and tell stories and share stories and things of that nature. So I eventually decided that was the way I wanted to go. And then I went to I asked Kathy, I said, can I go to the ACA conference as a non-member? I think at the time we didn't do that. I think I might have been one of the first, or maybe it wasn't done that often at that time. So I went out to Colorado at the time. I think it was in Vail. Went to the conference. I was like blown away with the people that I met, and listening to the speakers and listening to the other members. Much like Jim said, it's truly a community, and sort of like an evangelist, I guess. I just signed up right there and became a member. Again, the process is different now, where we sort of weed people out, not qualify people, I guess I should say, making sure that they're, serious about starting a business and filing all their filings and all that stuff before you can be accepted into membership. At that time, I think there was more hand-holding and hope that you would do all those things. Now it's a much neater process, and that whole process is done very, very well by the folks that do that within the ACA. And so here I am. That was 2005. It was when I actually registered with the state of Ohio. It was in January of 2005. Got audited by the state of Ohio in May of 2005, but did not have any clients yet. So that was actually, by the time they showed up, I had one client. So that was a pretty interesting audit. But again, with the help of the ACA, I knew what to do and how to prepare for that. So that's a little bit of my background. I volunteer a lot within the organization because I get so much out of the organization that I feel like I want to and should volunteer back, to the point now that I'm in my third year of being on the board. So I'll leave the rest for you to ask questions, but I do have a lot more to say but I'll leave it up to the questions.
Yeah, everyone probably noticed John's not really shy either. So, but great. Thank you both, John and Jim, for kind of giving your a little bit more about your background and about ACA. Now, Kim and Steve, I mean, what questions can they answer for you? And what, maybe you can share a little bit with us, too, about your goals for your practice, why you're looking at ACA, any information you'd also like to share with us so that we can help make sure you get the information you need.
Yeah, Steve, do you want to go ahead first?
Yeah, sure. How did you find, so if I kind of understand what you all said, some of the differences that you noticed between like Garrett and ACA was the level of training, and then just the different approach with the retainer approach versus maybe a longer term relationship approach. Is that pretty much sum up what your views are?
Yeah, for me, I just didn't want to get in the position where I was always having to try to attract clients. At some point under this model, you'll get to the point, and it's different for different folks. It could be a couple years, it could be 8 years, but at some point you'll be up to capacity. You'll have all the work you can do because you'll have a self-generating, self-sustaining practice. With the Garrett model, it's great for folks who want to come in and have a couple problems that they want to have solved. And they have a lot of good folks that can do that kind of work, and they do a good job at it. It's just you're always having to beat the bushes and find clients because it's just a more limited scope of engagement. I'll give you an example about getting to know clients. A half hour before this call, folks came in for some tax planning, and she dropped the bombshell that she just had bladder cancer. If she was just going to see someone who they see, you know, once a year type of thing, just checking in, she probably wouldn't have said that. So we spent a good part of the conversation talking about that and what it meant, and she really opened up, and, I don't think you're going to get that with a very limited scope engagement.
Yeah, to follow up on what Jim said, it just came down to talking to the other ACA members when I first got started. And this holds true today, so this is 8 years later. Everyone loves what they do, and they love their, everyone has a grumpy client or two, but, just some of the stories you get to tell about your clients, again, without violating any sort of privacy, it's just those things like, like Jim just said, I have a client that just came in and said, I have bladder cancer, or, I have a client that they really wanted to move, I was able to help them do that, and reach their goals it's just really neat to experience that rather than be in a less engaged environment. The other thing that I got, and this will come out, I can't tell you how much value, this is like the MasterCard commercial, the price of membership is X, but this is invaluable, is, I really, different than how Jim runs his practice, I really want to maintain a sole practitioner environment. I just like the idea of running it myself. Well, the ACA, as I often refer to it, is my first employee. And the amount of support that I get, not just from the tools and this and that you can get within the ACA, it's again, looking back on the community, our discussion forum. I tell clients all the time, when you're in, my office is, 10 feet by 15 feet? It's not that big. And that's it. This is Disability Financial Planning. It's me. However, I have 150 virtual partners. If there's something I don't know, I post it on the discussion forum, and usually within 24 to 48 hours, there's some sort of response that either gets me the answer or points me in the right direction. And then I can collaborate from there, much like Jim referred to having a couple of ACA members on speed dial. That's sort of the same thing, but it's out there publicly for all to learn. There's oftentimes I read other people's postings like, I have to remember that in case it comes up for me, or I can flag it, and keep it as a favorite of mine, whatever. But that was really, really important to me, that whole sense of community. Again, you sort of can't put a price on that, although I can say it saves me from having to hire. So, there is a financial equation there, but it also makes me much more confident in dealing with my clients in that if I run across something I don't know, Kathy joked that I'm not shy. I'm also not shy about saying, hell if I know, to a client, but I'll find out, and they're fine with that, and they'll wait a week for a response if that's how long it takes. And what's nice, too, is then they also know, I took the time to research it. It wasn't just off the top of my head. So that I got much more of that feeling from ACA than I did Garrett. Again, I'm not trying to portray us against them type of thing, but that's the feeling I got. I would suggest that you talk to folks that at Garrett to find out how, you know, they interact with other members.
Yeah,
I just would throw in there, I mean, certainly I don't think any of us on this call or really anyone in ACA, unless they had just recently joined and had been a member of Garrett, we certainly don't try to represent ourselves as, you know, knowing the details of that organization or the experience. What I can say, having been with ACA from day one, is I've always seen that people are just naturally drawn toward one model or the other, and that it really seems to come down to the type of relationship that you want to have with your clients. Cheryl Garrett's has always been very upfront about how for her having a relationship that had a clear end to it was very important to her and kind of a big part of how she developed and why she chose the hourly model. I think those who tend to go with ACA are the ones who are really want to have long-term relationships with their clients.
John kind of touched on it too, that this type of business is scalable. Some folks come into the organization and say, hey, I want to be a one-man shop, I want to be lean and mean, and some people come in and say, hey, I want to build an empire. I want to have half dozen planners under me and support staff and everything in between. So it's definitely scalable to what you want your vision to be, whether it's a solo practitioner or a multi-member firm.
So you have the various kinds of those planners within ACA?
Absolutely.
You're saying?
Absolutely.
And Kathy, I think you can speak to that too, that, you know, that there are a variety of different practices within the ACA. We have practices with that are very, very small, solo practitioners, or what I hope to have is a relatively large solo practitioner client business, to multi-member firms, to firms that are basically CPAs that just run some financial planning stuff on the side. And you can grow it to however you want to grow it, you know. So.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a broad spectrum.
Kim,
I'd like to hear more about the mentoring program. Does it have a formal structure, or is it more, you know, kind of as needed, or as the parties, you know, agree among each other? And how much time do mentors typically spend with a new member? Can you each speak about your experience on that?
Yeah, when I came in, this again 5 years ago, I was assigned a coach because the training at that time, I don't know what it is now, quite frankly, but it was about a six-month process. So I had a weekly call with my coach. And just doing a lot of the background stuff to get me ready to open the financial planning practice while I was going through training. Okay, you need to get your ADV done. You need to get your NAFTA plan done. You need to do this. And just kind of held my feet to the fire to make sure I was getting things done. So when I came out of the training class, the week intensive training at the end, my office was open and I was ready to go. Just recently, within the last year or so, I've been mentoring a couple of the new advisors that have been maybe in the organization for a year to 2 years. So we talk to each other at least once a month. Probably there's a lot of email exchanges. Probably more like every couple of weeks, we'll have a good talk for half hour, 45 minutes, and I just told her to call whenever, you know, regarding anything. And she's kind of going through some opportunities that have come up recently, so we've been talking a lot about that. So I really enjoy that. That's a lot of fun to me.
The mentoring program I don't think was as formal when I went, when I joined. I did a visiting planner. Do we still have that?
That piece to it is a little more informal than it was when you first joined.
Yeah. But so I went and visited a whole bunch of planners that were in the Ohio-Michigan area. I basically took a road trip for a week and went around and visited a whole bunch of members in their practices. They were very nice to open up their practice and spend either, in some cases, a couple hours, in some cases, half a day or even a whole day with me. And that was terrific. So and then, again, as Jim referred to, I get a pretty decent amount of phone calls from new members just asking me questions, because I do a lot of these type of phone calls. I do this phone call, and then once you're a member, there's some conference calls that lead up to your initial training session, and I do one of those calls typically for every session, and I always tell folks on the call, here's my name, here's my number, here's my contact info, call me, contact me if you have questions, and they do. So while I haven't done a formal mentoring program, I do a lot of, just phone calls and emails to help people get through something or if they have a question.
Yeah, I think our mentoring, it's an area that we, I think we're always looking for the best possible way to structure this to make it as effective as possible. And so it's gone through several variations throughout the years, and it was one way when John first joined it, another way when Jim first joined it, and I think it's quite a bit different now. And that a lot of that setup information, like your ADV and all the stuff you need to get your practice going, I think we do more of that. We now have on staff someone who acts as the new member concierge to help with a lot of those kind of a little bit more routine issues, so that when you're working with your mentor, it can be a little more focused on either client issues or, more your bigger practice goal type things. And there is a structure to it, but we also try to allow the flexibility for you and your mentor to determine, what is it that you need and set that up, because it definitely varies from person to person. So we don't try to dictate every aspect of that relationship. We just try to make sure that you get matched up with someone that you can have a good relationship with and can really help you as you move forward with your practice.
The one thing I'd like to point out with that response is you'll notice what Kathy said, that the process has changed. But that's what I'd like to point out, is that we're constantly trying to improve, and that's based on member feedback. Each and every member's voice is heard, and heard very well. Some members are more vocal than others, but there's a constant striving to say that, look, this is a member organization, and you're going to get out of it what you put into it. And if something needs to be changed or improved upon, great, we'll do the best that we can to do that. And also, hey, by the way, why don't you help in that process, since you have something to say about it? And oftentimes that's fantastic, because that's how we get people involved and improve any sort of system within the ACA.
Great. Which of the, I know ACA has a lot of tools to use. Which of the ACA tools have you found to be the most useful and maybe, continue to use now?
In our practice, we use all of the ACA tools. We don't, the only off-the-shelf program that we use is our tax program. But as far as, doing MoneyGuide Pro or any of that stuff, we just use the Cambridge tools as packaged.
I am also heavily dependent on the ACA tools. I don't have any, ACA doesn't offer a tax program, so again, the only thing I have that's not ACA is my tax software. The thing that I think I already mentioned, but I don't know if it's a tool or not, but it's the forums. It's the discussion forum. That is the single biggest thing that I use. Yeah, I can find something else that'll calculate, you know, retirement cash flow. I can go out and use MoneyGuide Pro. I can find replacements for all those so-called tools. But what I can't find a replacement for is the interaction of the membership. And yes, we're also members of NAPA since we're members of the ACA, and the NAPA has a forum. But it's NAPA is also a safe environment to post questions and get responses, but not nearly as intimate and directly like my business as the ACA forums are. Like I said, I can't tell you the amount of research it saves me, the time on researching, confidence I have, because usually accompanying with an answer that I get from another member is a story that goes along with it. And I can say, that's exactly like me, or that's not exactly like me, but, or my client situation. So that is the single biggest tool that I utilize.
Yeah, to John's point, that's probably the second thing I do every morning is check on the discussion forum to see what postings have been up, just as a learning tool. You know, every once in a while I can reply to someone's request, but mostly it's just perusing and learning and just getting a view through the prism of another planner's view. It's wonderful.
What was the hardest part or aspect of your first year or two getting started?
Well, for me, I wanted to take a measured approach to growth, and you'll meet, if you become a member and you do your training, you'll meet Linda Lights. And I often refer to this line from Linda. She said, your job until you get 15 clients is to get 15 clients. And for me, that was the hardest part, but yet the most rewarding part as I ramped myself up to getting 15 clients. So, you know, I sort of had set a goal to get a new client every other month and was able to achieve that. I think now the way we have refined our getting started process, that you can certainly have a much more aggressive goal than that. I had other reasons to keep mine sort of measured. My wife is also self-employed, and I was helping her with her business at the time. So because all the other stuff is just stuff. I mean, getting registered with your state security, you just got to get that done. You know, getting your you know, some people, you know, I can refer to a couple of our members that, goodness gracious, they took about 4 months to figure out what their name was going to be. You know, it's like, you know, doesn't really matter in the end what your name is. And your marketing materials. We have a lot of, you know, sort of get you rolling on the marketing stuff. It's realizing that sitting around waiting for the phone to ring is not the best way to grow your business. Not that I didn't do that, but that's the thing. And you have to be motivated to get out there and make your business work. All the other stuff is just things to do, and you can get those done. And I think that's sort of what Jim was referring to with the mentoring program. You know, someone wagging your finger at you and say, hey, you know, gotta get this done, gotta get that done. So that's just task oriented, and having someone wag their finger to say get it done is the easy part. It's you doing something to get out there and grow your business is the harder thing. At least it was for me.
Yeah, I'm kind of came in a unique situation. You know, I just got out of training. And there was another planner here in the Columbus area that had built up a nice little practice, and at this point she was in her early 60s, and said, "Hey, she approached me and said, 'Hey, I've got some smaller clients that I would like to start shedding off to you, because I've got more than I can handle, and I want to start cutting back.'" And the more she thought about it, she approached me one day about actually, well, it's kind of funny the way she said it. She said, you know, I think we should merge our practices together. And this is a week after I've got back from training. I still was assembling some office furniture when she stopped in one day. And I said, well, Joanne, if you mean a practice as actually having clients, I don't have a practice, which she knew that. She was just being nice. But she approached me to be a partner in her firm because she was at the point where she needed to do some succession planning. She, like I said, she was in her early 60s at that point and still loved the work, loved her clients, but knew that she, you know, that her clients are going to need somewhere to go at some point, whether it's 5 or 10 years down the road. So we sat down and worked out an agreement and went to an attorney and had all that drawn up. So it was a little different situation for me than for others. But this is starting to happen more and more with folks who've been in the organization for 15 years that have built up a nice practice and need to do some succession planning. So there is opportunities to partner up with other members in the organization.
Roughly, what is the membership retention rate after, you know, 1 year, 2 years, 4 years?
Are you talking about the client retention or the membership retention?
No, the ACA membership retention.
Kathy?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that's probably a question to me. Let me... I don't have those numbers off the top of my head. Let me look them up if you want to ask another question in the meantime, and then I'll come back on and give you the answer to that one.
It seems to me the members that stick around are the members that are active, that you see them at the conferences, you see them on other committees, you see them prominent on the discussion forum. It's kind of you get out of it what you put into it. You know, John mentioned that he likes to serve. He's on the board and other committees. The folks that you don't see as being very active members, those are the type of folks that tend to drift away at some point.
Yeah, and along those lines, again, you know, I think back in 05, 06, you know, we took a look at our retention rate, and we decided to do something about it because there was a higher turnover rate at that time. And that's where some of the processes changed with regard to making sure that you have a viable idea of how to run a business, you know, so that I think as a requirement of membership now, and I don't know if Kathy's still on the line or not, but I think, as I recall from our board discussions, that I mean, you're supposed to have a business plan in place, and you should have already taken the steps to file with the state securities department, and all those things, and then the whole 6 months of training, you know, before training, the conference calls and things like that, so that that those retention rates should be significantly higher than they once were, and I do believe that they are. And it's terrific. You know, I'll tell you what, you know, being as involved as I am in this process, in the early part of people just being interested in the ACA, and then once you become a member, going through the preparation for training, I'm always... enjoy meeting new members and some of the knowledge that new members bring to the forums and to the conference is just fantastic. It's so interesting to see new members start posting on the discussion forum because you can just see, this person seems to know what's going on. Boy, I can't wait to learn more about that person's practice or see them posting more on the discussion forums. You know, at some point, I feel like the old guy on the yelling at kids to get off the lawn. You know, not that I'm so long in the tooth, but you know, certainly there's other members that have been members much longer than I have. But it is sort of neat to see the new members come in and begin contributing. And that's part of what Jim talked about, that through the process of making sure that you're a good fit for the ACA, you should be able to jump right in. But there's other folks that, you know, they join and they're in that, I'm really going to sit back and just pick off what I need to get started. And then all of a sudden it's 2 or 3 years in, you're like, I remember you. And the next thing you know, they're like leading some committee. I'm thinking of someone in particular when I mention that. And there's a gal out there who is in her, I think she's in her 50s, and now she's leading one of our committees. And for the first couple of years, it was nothing but just a couple of questions here and there about how to help her grow her business or do some sort of practice management. And then now she's like, really contributing. So it's terrific to see the growth of members.
And just piggybacking on John's comment, I was talking to an ACA planner a year or two ago, and he's been in for 12 years, and we're having our annual update conference in a month or two. And he said he really looks forward to that, you know, just seeing old colleagues and catching up with folks that he's known for, you know, 10 or 12 years. But he said he really needs to make a point, and he wants to make a point of getting to know the new members, getting to know this new collective wisdom and expertise that's coming into the organization. It's really wonderful to see new folks coming in and the skills and assets that they bring.
Yeah, and just to give you a few numbers, I mean, overall as an organization, our average annual retention rate of members is right around 92%. Of those members who do terminate their membership, it ends up splitting about 50-50 between those who do leave within, you know, the first 3 years of membership. Those are generally, we've had some newer members who kind of get in here as a career changer and say, wow, this isn't what I was thinking it was going to be. I don't want to be a financial planner after all. As well as those who, quite frankly, just are unable to establish a viable practice. So, you know, it's probably pretty evenly split those within the first 3 years of that. We've got, you know, very few who leave after 1 year of membership. Probably the highest is after, at the end of 2 years of membership. Of those who terminate, 23% of the members who leave after their second year of membership. So 23% of that, 8.5%.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. How closely did each of you follow ACA methodology when you were first getting started? Did you deviate at all or follow it strictly? If you did deviate, how and why, and how did that work out?
We've stuck with the core methodology. Again, my partner has been in the organization since 96, and I can read Bert's book and the principles that he laid out, and we're probably still doing 95% of that. It's a system that's been in place for years and years, been applied to tens of thousands of clients across the country, and it works. It makes sense. And I know that sitting on both sides of the desk as a client and as an advisor.
I am about the same. I'm pretty much pure ACA, which, you know, is not the case. There's plenty of advisors within the ACA on the bell curve, on one end, you know, I think Jim and I are probably as close to pure ACA as anyone else. But on the other spectrum, there's folks that, you know, that they run their practice completely unique to anyone else's practice, and, you know, maybe only retain their membership so that they can be a member, you know, be on the discussion forum. So when we say, you just happen to have two people on the call that are Pure Cambridge. There's lots of ways to practice. There's some folks that do hate taxes. As a sort of follow-up, I end up loving the whole tax side of things, by the way, now that I'm an ASA member. But there's some folks that just, they don't want anything to do with taxes, and they outsource that whole side. They still do the tax planning, which, again, like Jim said, clients love that part. What I tell folks on that initial call leading up to the training, because this question comes up, because either they've already been doing some planning and they think they know how to do it themselves a little differently, that's great. What I tell folks is, much like Linda says, until you get 15 clients, your job is to get 15 clients. Don't try and improve upon anything until you've got some sea legs, get your sea legs underneath you. Because my experience was I did try and tweak one or two things sort of right out of the box, and it was like a year or two later when I said, gee, I'm not very successful at what I'm trying to do here. Why don't I go back to how I was taught? And lo and behold, things got much better. I'm not saying it's perfect because everyone practices differently and you might have different strengths and weaknesses. But I say, stick with what you're taught through the ACA, especially if you've never done it before. And why do you, as Jim said, the method is tried, true, and works. If you haven't done it, what makes you think that you can do it better? You might have an idea that you want to practice differently, and that will eventually grow into your own practice, and that's fine. But I do highly recommend that you sort of stick to the process as relayed to you or taught to you until you sort of can figure out where you'd like to deviate rather than say, okay, as soon as I get started, I'm going to deviate. So just my thoughts.
Yeah, I agree. I like to say I'm definitely not the smartest person, but I'm smart enough to know what I don't know. That's another big reason why I joined this is just because so much stuff was already in place. Where I didn't have to, build things from the ground up. And I think, if you join and go through training, you're highly encouraged to do this system as it's taught, for the first 2, 3, 4 years. And then you'll kind of have some solid footing, and there may be some tweaks here and there to do. But I think if you do it the way it's taught and work hard as far as generating the clients and not just sit in your office tweaking spreadsheets, you'll be successful.
I have to step off, but this has been very, very helpful and informative, and I appreciate everyone's time. And, Kathy, I'll look forward to hearing from you.
Yeah, if you just want to, if you can shoot me an email, if we can actually schedule a time, that would be anytime next week or even over the weekend, whatever is most convenient for you. I'm here and available, so.
And Stephen, Kim, the offer does hold. If you want to talk to me, feel free to contact me, and you can get my information from Kathy.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Sure. Bye.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks.
Kim?
Yes.
Any other questions? Or do you have a tax practice or an accounting practice?
Well, I have. When I originally started as in accounting, in my public accounting career, I did about 4 seasons tax work, but I migrated to doing controller type work on a contract basis for a variety of clients, and been doing that for 23 years. But financial planning has always been an interest and a hobby for me. So I'm interested in knowing from you, John, what skills as a CPA do you think has been particularly helpful or, maybe even a bit of a hindrance with your work in becoming a financial planner?
It amazes me how many CPAs don't become financial planners, actually, because I think it is a relatively easy transition from the standpoint of if you're interested in your clients. Some CPAs just, they just want to crank through the debits and credits and get it done, push it out the door, and be done with it. But if you take a particular interest in your clients, and like you said, it seems like you do, I think it's a great career transition. And seeing that you come from the controller, the CFO for hire type side, I think that's actually an easier transition, because the harder transition are folks that do have a robust CPA practice, and they have a hard time cutting the cord. You know, they have the reliable cash flows from that, and you know, they just don't commit hard enough to the financial planning side. The ones that do well, but the ones that have a hard time, it's almost always, if you were to do a Harvard Business Review, and so they just, you know, didn't embrace it as much as they should have. You know, the whole idea of providing management letters or feedback, that's the same thing you're doing here. You know, we write up notes to every meeting, and provide them to the client. You're trying to draw information from the client. So to the extent that, you know, I think you in particular, having sort of done this part-time CFO work or contract CFO work, I think that's a terrific transition. You know, and the whole idea of keeping stuff organized and as typical CPAs tend to be, that's helpful. You know, so like I said, the hindrance side is if you had a robust practice, but the natural side of things, especially from what you said your background is, I think will be a terrific transition for you.
Oh, that's very encouraging to hear. So what advice in particular would you give to me making this particular transition?
Well, keep doing what you're doing in the sense of make the evaluation. You know, much along the same lines as someone who does have a robust CPA or tax practice, you have to decide, you know, what you want to commit yourself to. It's hard to cut that cord because there are, I do know of one or two members, without naming names, I think Kathy probably knows who I'm talking about, that sort of had this CFO for hire type practice, like the idea of working with clients, but same, they sort of fell in the same problem that, gee, the next contract came up for, you know, fill in the blank thousands of dollars, I need to commit myself to that client because that's assured money, whereas, you know, going to open up my own financial planning practice, you know, that's not assured money. You have to go out and get the clients. So if you like the idea of working with clients and building a relationship with clients and the whole idea of being a financial planner, then commit to it. What I would recommend that you do is start to figure out where you're going to get clients from. Here in Cincinnati, as well as Columbus, we're pretty lucky in that NAPFA already has a pretty good foothold here in Ohio, and all the other NAPFA members in town already have their own niche, and they're very gracious with their time. I went and talked to every single one of them, and found out what their particular specialty was, and told them how I plan to operate my business, and they were very gracious, and they refer clients to me all the time. I have a message on my machine when I got in this morning. Hello, my name is so-and-so. I got I was given your name from another NAPFA member here in town. So I'd say 50% of my referrals are from other NAPFA members. That's what I would recommend is to commit, but also understand where you're going to need to spend your time growing that practice. And the thing that can derail you is if you get someone that calls you up and says, hey, you know, I'd like to hire for the next 9 months through a transition. We'll pay you $100,000 to do that. And I'm not saying you should say no to that. I mean, that might be what's best for you and your family, that you have that money coming in. But the biggest hindrance will be that competition for your time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that totally makes sense. Are we out of time, or do we have time for more questions?
Go for it.
No, I got time.
Okay. How much time, speaking of time, how much time do you spend on the admin stuff, you know, particularly in your first year and then, you know, on ongoing as more of a maintenance level later? And what
yeah, you
does
probably
that
have a different
stuff
perspective.
Look like?
Yeah, when I came on board, my partner, she had a full practice. At that time, she had about 60 clients, and she had a gentleman that works for he was working probably about 30 hours a week doing a lot of the admin back office stuff. If you set your systems up properly in the beginning, I think you'll find that you can keep that to a minimum. And at some point, you can hire, once the ball really starts rolling, you get some clients under your belt, you can hire, a lot of folks use virtual assistants to help them do some of the back office stuff. Maybe John can talk more about that.
Yeah, having come from public accounting and all that, you'd think I'd be nuttier about the admin side. I don't spend a whole lot of time on admin. Because I'm a good guy. I mean that from the standpoint of I'm not doing anything that warrants a problem from, like, compliance. So, you know, knowing that I do things properly, I don't really worry about the admin side of things. Now you got to get your bills out and you have to make sure you file your ADV and all those good things. You know, you go to one conference and listen to Tom Giannetti talk about all the compliance issues, you know, you'll be shaking in your boots. But the end result is if you just stay compliant and do what you're supposed to do, you don't have to spend a whole lot of time on the admin side. But I'm probably a little bit more on the, you know, what's the term we're using? Laissez-faire? Like, I sound like I'm intelligent there, but I'm but it's, I just don't sweat that stuff all that much, you know. And so, but there are some people that are nutty about that stuff, and they read all the forthcoming IRS proposals and this and that. It's like until it's a law. I'm interested to hear what they're proposing and it might impact my business, what the new compliance rules might be, but I don't have time to waste on what it might be until it's reality for my practice. There was something about that. There was a lot of noise about some bill that was about to get passed, and then it ended up not getting passed. So again, some people spent a ton of time worrying about it, but you know, I chose not to.
There's a lot of folks that like to chase down everything in every rabbit hole. And that could really suck your time, so you just have to be careful of that.
Do what you're supposed to do. And one of the guys that Jim works with, he has a great, and talking about the mentoring program, it was one of the guys I visited. He devotes a week in the summer when it's slow. I think he still does this. He reviews everything in his office. You know, his compliance manual, his ADV, and he just takes a week to sort of self-examine, and that's a good way to do it. I've tried to do that, haven't been so successful in doing that, but I do tell people that I think that's a good way to do it.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I'm kind of switching gears. I'm curious what you both do about your investment management side. Do you custodian with somebody or have clients have a retail account that you assist them with, or how do you approach that?
We use a custodian. We use TD Ameritrade. But I know that a lot of ACA folks, especially folks starting out, have clients just to have retail accounts at Vanguard. Because a lot of the custodians, they'll want a minimum amount of assets, $10 million or whatever the number is. But there's a newer custodian that came out several years ago, Shareholder Services Group, SSG, that they don't have any minimums. So if you think that that might be where your practice is headed, it would probably make sense to go that route up front to work with a custodian like SSG if you don't have the assets, instead of having people do retail accounts and get to the point where it gets kind of unwieldy, and then you're like, well, I need to get everyone transitioned over to this custodian, which is a lot of paperwork, and it's not a huge hassle, but it's just something, if you think you're going to go that route, you might want to do it up front.
I'm different. I sort of chose not to custody any of my clients' assets. It was a differentiating factor for me in the Cincinnati marketplace. Because there is a pretty robust NAPA membership here in town, and they almost all have minimums, and almost all require you to move your assets to their custodian, I said, well, I'd like to position myself as different. I don't custody any assets anywhere. I have all my clients at their various and sundry retail accounts. So I have some folks at E-Trade, Schwab, Vanguard, Fidelity, wherever. Now, if they don't have a preference, I would prefer them to go to Vanguard, just because I like their everything about them. But I don't make them move. However, I would say, I have a relationship with SSG in case anyone wants to do that. Like Jim said, though, if you think you want and you can, whether it's discretionary or non-discretionary, that's a different level of how you want to manage money. If you think you're going to want to do that, I would say do it up front, because that transition is difficult. Not impossible, but it's time-consuming. And talk about admin, that will take up a bunch of your time to switch people from their retail accounts to a custodian, especially if you're trying to do it across a practice that now has 10, 15, 20 clients. So if you think you want to do that, I would do that. I'd make that decision up front as best you can imagine and go from there.
And a lot of it might have to do with your actual clientele. We tend to attract folks who are, pretty in their pre-retirement stage, within a few years of retirement. They're going to be rolling over their 401k. They like the idea of having things consolidated into one custodian at one point. If you're dealing with other folks who are younger, maybe most of their assets are in their 401k. There's not really anything to put at a custodian. So I think another consideration is who are the clients you're going to be working with as far as using the custodian or not. I just like it too because, you have one log on to TD Ameritrade and you can see anyone's account at any time.
Yeah, I do think that's the better way to go. But if you choose not to, you don't have to. And then further along the investing side, what I would tell you is we have, to actually do the investing, we have a suggested funds list, and there's always a lot of discussion on the forums and at the conference about different styles of investing. And, again, that's one of those things that you can, I think Jim said, you get sucked down the rabbit hole discussing, should I be investing in foreign bonds and given treasuries and this, you can spend as much time on that as you'd like and become a super guru from an investing standpoint, or you can just be totally passive. Part of the cost of membership that I think is invaluable is that suggested funds list. When I roll off the board, I've avoided being on that committee. Not from an avoidance standpoint, but just sort of, like I said, I was a controller for a mutual fund company. I worked at a high net worth money manager. I've been around that side of the business for basically basically my whole career, and made a choice. I sort of didn't want to get involved on that within the ASCA when I first got started because I'd been involved in that for so long. But I can see myself moving in that direction as the next committee that I'm involved with. But I'll tell you that much. I mean, that's a huge time and money saver to have that suggested funds list. To the extent that you want to rely on it 100%, to the extent that you just want to reference it to know that it's there, I don't have to have an investment staff. I use my own noggin and do my own research. And, oftentimes a client comes to you that their money is in a 401k and none of the funds in their plan are on the suggested funds list. So you have to review all their funds and figure out which ones are best within their plan. But from an execution of the investing, not just the custodial side, and there's two lists. There's a passive funds list and a active funds list, and it's broken down by all the different subcategories, large cap, small cap, growth value, all that good stuff. That's a huge, to me, time and money saver is to have that be a member benefit.
Great, that sounds really helpful. What about, is there even, model portfolios, percentage in this, percentage in that for people in, particular phase of life?
There's not full-blown model portfolios. I don't know of any, but I do know that some folks that have them, and I think they're reasonably open about talking about them, and I think I've seen postings on the forum. Yeah, I have a model portfolio, and they won't post it on the forum per se, but they might send it to someone if they're asked or something like that. And I do think some of the custodians sort of allow you to set up model portfolios too. I'm not sure that SSG does, but I think Trade PMR or one of those groups even allows you to do that. So when someone comes in, they just go right into the model portfolio. But I don't think as a organization we have a model portfolio, but that suggested funds list then flows into what we sort of have as not model portfolios, but probably model allocations. Those allocations, again, they might be model allocations, but you're free to tweak them as is. So if you're a pre-retiree, maybe you're currently 60-40, stocks to bonds, but maybe now you should be trending towards 50-50 as you enter retirement. And then within the stock side, you might want to be 60% large cap, 16% small cap, and 24% international. Those types of allocations are out there, but not the detail underneath those allocations.
Okay.
That's true, right?
Yeah, I think that's correct. There is no model portfolio that's published by the organization. In the training program, as you're learning about functional asset allocation, which is the ACA approach, there are going to be kind of some recommendations that are also tied to the financial life cycle, and I think there's things that we provide that make that easier for you to develop, or to, as John said, to get from someone else, but we don't actually publish that.
And the question, probably a logical question, follow up to that, Kim, since you're interested in this topic, is the idea of an investment policy statement. Some folks have them, some folks don't. I don't have an investment policy statement with my clients; it's sort of inferred, but I don't write up a formal one. Some folks do. And some folks live and die by that thing too, So, Jim, do you guys do anything along those lines?
We do not do policy statements. But to John's point, it's funny how even planners who do core Cambridge, just how different they can do little things as far as having this policy statement, and how some folks get really low in the weeds on investments. So, there again, it it's your practice, and you go with the strengths that you have. But there's just folks all over the map who are really good at something, and you'll get to know those folks.
Yeah. One of the things that I think I want to come across with, Kim, is Cambridge, or the Alliance of Cambridge Advisors, the ACA, Jim mentioned really early on that, you know, it's not turnkey, but you certainly are giving a box, and that you can say, here it is, start your practice. Once you're in, you can run your practice any way you want. You happen to have two guys on the phone that run it pretty much pure Cambridge, but you know, within investments, there might be 130 different ways that people run investments out of the 170 members that we have, or 150, I don't know what number we're at. There might be 15 different ways people run taxes. There might be, you're free to run it however you want. And, in fact, that's sort of what makes it great. You know, you post something, and again, I'm going to use the word safe. You post something on the discussion forum. I've seen postings in, either on NAPA or other public sites, and you know, in this age of the internet and blog postings and people posting comments to blog postings, some people can get vicious out there, right? I really have never seen a vicious comment. Now, someone might completely disagree or take a completely different approach towards doing whatever. I don't care what the practice management is. They'll just say, here's how I do it. I do it differently. I'm sure at some point someone's gotten offended by a posting, although I can't imagine that happening very often. I don't know of it happening very often. And certainly as a board member, if it did happen, we'd want to do something about it. I don't know what that would be, but did we create the environment somehow to allow that to happen, or what can we do to prevent it from happening in the future? We're very cognizant of that. But it does allow you to think about, hey, I thought I wanted to run my practice this way. I'm hearing a lot of feedback of people running it this other way. I might want to change. And what's very interesting is if you do end up writing a business plan or you have a business plan in place, is to go back and look at it 5 years later and say, what the hell was I thinking when I wrote that business plan? I was pretty close to how I envisioned it. It does allow you to change or adapt to either better practices or something that you think, after having been in business for 2 or 3 years, I don't like the way this is going in my practice. I'm going to go and do it more like Jim or Tom or Fred or whoever. You'll meet great people and you'll say, gosh, that Jenna out in California, she runs her practice really interestingly. I'd like to be more like her or run something more like her. So that variety is helpful. It's not a franchise.
Good point.
Okay. I think we kind of need to bring this to a close. Great questions, Kim. And great information, Jim and John. Thank you so much for being on this. And
if you send Kim and Steve a follow-up email, please include my contact information. Please, contact
excellent.
Us.
Excellent. I was just going to ask you if I had your permission to do that, so thanks.
Yeah, same here.
Okay. I will definitely provide them both with your contact information for additional questions. And, Kim, I know we were going to talk in about 10 minutes. Can we put that off a little bit longer?
Sure, of course.
Okay, if I, maybe do it at the, it would be 1:45, 15 minutes later. Does that work for you? Eastern time, of course.
That's perfect. Yeah, call me whenever you're ready. Anytime's fine for me.
Okay, all right, great. Well, I guess I should go ahead and stop the recording, but thanks, everybody. Great call.
Good luck.
Nice talking with you, Kim.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You both were extremely helpful. I appreciate all your candidness.
Okay.
You're in Portland, correct?
I am. Uh-huh.
Okay, go see the other Cambridge folks in Portland if you haven't done so already.
I have. And
Good.
They're great guys. And they have spoken so highly of Cambridge, so that's why I'm here talking to you today.
Great.
Yeah, I'm really, really seriously considering this.
Well,
everything
good.
I hear I just like more and more what I hear.
Good. And if it's in the budget, we're having our conference in a month or two in Detroit. There would be a great opportunity to meet folks.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. I think I'm heading to Detroit.
Oh, good.
Excellent.
John will buy you a beer.
Yeah. Please introduce yourself.
All right, folks. Kathy has to go. Thanks a lot, folks.
Great.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
We'll see you. Bye.
Okay. Bye.